You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Pratap.
Hello, Bob. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Let me introduce us. After asking you how you're doing, though, how are you doing?
I mean, I'm personally fine. I mean, the world is an interesting place to think about these days, but
you that's know, a polite fine. Way to put right. it. And we're going right. to be getting into that as right. people will understand after I introduce you. So first of all, I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero newsletter, to which I encourage people to subscribe. This is the Non-Zero podcast. You are Pratap Mehta. If I pronounce that kind of right, M-E-H.
Absolutely right. Perfect.
It's just perfect. Perfection. And you are a prominent academic, political scientist, both in India and in the United States. You're currently at Princeton for this semester. You're more commonly found in India. You're also a noted political analyst and commentator there. And you figured in a controversy involving the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, that gives you a particular kind of vantage point in a way on what the United States is now going through with Donald Trump. So let me just say a little more about this, because what I want to eventually do is step back and have you do kind of a compare and contrast broadly on the experience in India under Modi and our current experience under Trump, and maybe even give those of us who are worried about him some tips on what the most constructive ways to respond are. So as we speak, J.D. Vance, vice president, is in India. And, you know, that would always be of some interest when a vice president goes to India. But in this case, there's something of an ideological alignment between the U.S. administration and the Modi government. Both have been called ethno-nationalist. I would say the labels maybe apply in somewhat different ways to the extent that they apply. And we'll get into that. But both have been seen as having authoritarian leanings and to have caused concern. And Modi has now been in power a little over 10 years. And so you've had a chance to observe what he's been up to, how he has succeeded to some extent, and your personal experience attests to this, in controlling speech, suppressing certain kinds of speech. And so I want to kind of hear what you've learned, but why don't we start out? I should also say you're an author of a number of books. One is The Burden of Democracy. And you've been something of, I said you're something of a political analyst and commentator in India. You've written a column for, what is it, the Indian Express?
The Indian Express.
Right. Yeah. So tell us about your personal experience. And you were at this point, this is 2021, you were both a professor and an administrator at Ashoka University. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's a sequence to it. I was actually vice chancellor, which is the equivalent of the president. It's the academic head of the university. And I stepped down voluntarily in 2020 because I had come to the conclusion, and I was led to believe, that my heading the institution would put the institution at risk because of my views and my criticisms of the Modi government. And I had informed the trustees that I'm willing to step down and actually go back to being a professor, in part because it would shield the institution from identification with my views. But also in part, as faculty, you supposedly have more degrees of freedom, right? I mean, you don't have fiduciary responsibility for the institution. And in some ways, you're freer to express your views. Mm-hmm. So I then became a professor at Ashoka. But a few months after I became professor, I was called in by the trustees and basically told that my presence was a political liability to the university. That's the exact phrase. I mean, I said a lot of other things, but the core of the point was that. And essentially, the message was that if the trustees didn't rein me in some respects, either they or the university would suffer consequences. I then chose to resign, again, mainly to save the university. I mean, I could have engaged in a protracted battle. It's not easy to fire tenured professors in some ways. But I came to the conclusion that that was not going to be in a protracted battle was not going to be in anybody's interest at that point. And frankly, I was also beginning to get the sense that it wasn't just that there might have been outside pressure on the trustees. The trustees themselves, at least some of them, were beginning to more align with not just the government's point of view in terms of political point of view, but were actually, I think, a little bit too ready to compromise institutional autonomy. And so I resigned. My resignation became a bit of a public event. A couple of other professors resigned as well, including a very noted economist, Arvind Subramanian. So it became a matter of public controversy. The students came out on strike in support of us. And we then placated the students in some ways by saying, look, all things considered, as much as we'd like to be at this university, all things considered, this is the best course under circumstances. So that was one episode. But there was one other one, which I think was more to the point and perhaps more analogies with the US. Before I became Vice Chancellor of Ashoka, I headed a think tank, India's most prominent think tank, the Center for Policy Research, for almost 11 years. And I'm still affiliated with that think tank. And that think tank has been practically shut down by the government. Ostensibly, so this will resonate with your audience. They first withdrew the think tank's permission to receive foreign contributions. Then they went for its status as a charitable institution. And in a sense, these two regulatory interventions essentially made the think tank kind of unviable. So it still exists. I mean, it exists in legal form, but it has gone from about 170 people to having 3 employees. And it was a kind of very visceral demonstration of the way in which you can use tax law, administrative law, to exert pressure on institutions, and in some cases actually make them practically dysfunctional. And that's happened to actually a fair number of institutions in India.
They've actually been either shut down or neutralized.
Yeah. Or you make it kind of difficult for them to raise resources. You withdraw regulatory permissions, and the effect it has actually, even on a lot of institutions that survive, is that it sends a message to other institutions that they better stay in their whatever the government thinks their appropriate lane is. Otherwise, they would suffer consequences.
And in all of the cases involving you, it was pretty clear that the Modi government was ultimately behind it in an active way. I mean, pretty clearly it was with the think tank. They actually pulled levers of power. But at the university, your sense was that the initiative had come from Modi. I don't know. Did he ever single you out personally or?
No. So two things I think I want to clarify. One, Mr. Modi, in that sense, is unlike Donald Trump, which is one of the remarkable features of his career as prime minister is that except on one or two issues, which I'll come out to lately, he himself acts in the most high or talks in the most high-minded way possible. Mm-hmm. So he does not tweet like Donald Trump, issue personal threats like Donald Trump, actually explain the rationale behind policies like Donald Trump. In a sense, he operates, let's say, through a much more informal and therefore perhaps more effective in some ways system, a system with a little bit more plausible deniability, at least for highest levels of leadership. In that sense, he's actually quite different from Donald Trump. So I could not say, for example, that, he personally stole the trustees, but the trustees certainly communicated to me, and I think there is circumstantial evidence to back it up, that there was some political pressure on them. And when I wrote that in my resignation letter, that that because you've expressed this concern that I'm a political liability to the institution, they in a sense never formally denied that. But if you connect the dots, I mean, this has happened with a whole range of other institutions, and frankly, I'm one of the privileged ones, actually, or many people at our institutions were privileged. But there have been academics who suffered prison terms. Anand Teltumbe, a very prominent Dalit social thinker. Dalits are, you know, the ex-untouchables, marginalized communities in India. He spent a couple of years in prison.
What was the charge?
So the charge was basically, in his case, the charge was there was a agitation. There's a place in the state of Maharashtra, Bhima Koregaon, where Dalits were protesting. It's a long-standing kind of social flashpoint between upper caste and lower caste. And the charge in their case was that this was a kind of conspiracy to destabilize the state by fomenting agitations. But the biggest crackdown, actually, in terms of significance, was on one of India's largest, most important universities, Jawaharlal Nehru University, where the police raided the campus, put sedition charges on a number of student leaders who had been protesting on a range of issues. Now, admittedly, JNU has a long history of student activism. It's historically been identified with the left in some senses in India, but it has never been targeted this kind of way. And actually, a couple of those students are 4 years down the line, still in prison. The charges against them are sedition. But the courts have not even granted them a proper bail hearing. I mean, they find some technical reason or excuse to adjourn. So there's one student, for example, Umar Khalid, who's, you know, for 4 years languishing in prison. So there have been forms of intimidation that are, in a sense, far more severe, I think, than the ones, you know, the Center for Policy Research or Ashoka experienced.
Okay. And in all these cases, I gather the government there had been some criticism directed at the government, or you had been critical of Modi print, right? Personally.
So
before we get to, I mean, I think people can get a sense that Modi has kind of traveled further along the authoritarian road than Trump has so far, in the sense of kind of number of academic or intellectual institutions just kind of shut down or completely neutralized. I think the press has been stifled more in India than it has yet in the United States, although Trump is trying. And there's some evidence, at least the Washington Post, that Jeff Bezos is planning to. The reporting doesn't seem to have been affected. And for that matter, I don't think we've seen that much on the opinion page yet. But it seems pretty clear that Bezos wants to turn that a little more in Trump's direction. But by and large, we're not as far down this path as India has. Before we I ask you what you think we can do to keep from going too far down it, let's talk a little about the comparison broadly. So, as I said, they're both called ethno-nationalists. I would say that's a little more kind of literally true in the case of Modi, just in the sense that he appeals overtly to the Hindu tradition. Donald Trump doesn't go around saying we're a Christian nation. Yeah. Now, that's probably less for fear of offending Muslims, maybe, than of fearing other groups. But in any event, he doesn't say that. Yeah. He doesn't say we're a white nation. And, you know, his coalition is somewhat diverse.
Yeah.
There's another interesting, I'm going to ask you about this parallel, which is that, so with Trump, on the one hand, he was kind of first condemned for the left, you might say, for appealing to racism, bigotry directed toward immigrants. And yet, including especially Latin American ones, but also Muslims. But if you look at the resentment that drives many of his followers, it's actually directed more at elites who are not ethnically distinct from them. Yeah. Now, in Modi's case, viewed from afar, I think the average American who knows much about him would think, well, anti-Muslim, because for one thing, he burst on the political scene in a big way as a part of this thing. I guess I don't know how long it's been now, but it was before he was prime minister, and he was a regional official, I guess the equivalent of a governor. And this Muslim mosque was torn down by a Hindu mob, and there was, and I'm not sure exactly about the sequence of events. There was also rioting that I guess the Hindus would blame on. I'm going to let you pick up the story. First, I want to say that. So before you flesh out that background, there is this, obviously, this issue with Muslims. And of course, India's history makes that a particularly prominent issue.
Yeah.
But there is at the same time a resentment of elites that he is harnessing, much the way, just as Donald Trump says, there are these elites, mainly white, but they don't care about you whites in middle America. Yeah. They'd rather hang out with their fellow elites, in India, you know, than with you. Yeah. And so on. There is a little bit of a parallel, I think, there. Maybe. I'll let you tell us. But first, why don't you sketch out the history to whatever extent you think it needs to be sketched out?
So let me kind of begin the parallels, and I'll actually fold in the history into it, because I think the context will become clearer. So, first of all, it has to be said, Mr. Modi, like Trump was at the time of this election, recent most election, is an immensely popular figure. I mean, I don't think anybody can deny them that legitimacy. And just like Trump's victory feels a bit like a proper electoral victory, no matter what kind of one's kind of views on it. So they are popular figures. And Mr. Modi's popularity has actually been quite remarkable, personal popularity. Second, I think you're absolutely right that they both position themselves as outside figures destroying something like a corrupt, elitist, ancient regime, almost. And they literally describe it in those terms. This ancient regime has many characteristics that are similar for both society countries, which is, in India, Mr. Modi calls them left. Revolutionary, Trump calls them woke. Second, this construction that they're entirely self-serving and self-legitimizing. And they have captured almost all elite institutions, including institutions that normally should serve democracy. So both Mr. Trump and Mr. Modi have incredible impatience with institutions of checks and balances. You know, courts, for example. As we speak, Mr. Modi's party has launched a full-scale attack on this Indian Supreme Court, just like many of Mr. Trump's followers are doing for the American judicial system. But the core argument they are making is that the system of checks and balances, rather than protecting democracy, has become a way of thwarting the agency of the people. That, you know, the people want to get things done. The real people want to get things done, and the elites use checks and balances to put roadblocks, right? And so they're both anti-institutional and anti-elite. Because they're anti-institutional in part because they think institutions are weaponized by elites to actually protect their privileges. The third thing I think that's common to them, and this comes to the background history, is both can present themselves as being personally, politically victimized. So Mr. Trump says, look, I was prosecuted by the old regime, right? I mean, this is the prosecution could not reach the consequence that he could be disqualified from running to office, but he has a sense of being prosecuted. Mr. Modi has the same. The context is very different, and that's the historical context. Mr. Modi was chief minister of Gujarat state, and in 2002, a train was set on fire, one bogie carrying Hindu activists who were actually going to this site of this demolished mosque in Ayodhya, where they actually wanted to, in a sense, perform service and build up an agitation for building a temple there. So this train bogie gets burnt, and roughly about 50 Hindus died in the space of Godhra. In retaliation, there was violence, or it's alleged that it was in retaliation, in which, at the most conservative estimate, about 2,000 Muslims were killed, right? And the controversy was, Mr. Modi was chief minister. Was this a spontaneous retaliation? Was this all orchestrated? Did the state have complicity producing this violence? And so Mr. Modi and many of the ministers in this government were an object of investigation of the previous regime, which was basically alleging that they might have had an active role to play in these riots, right? Now, that prosecution was not, in a sense, a successful investigation, at least from the previous government's point of view. There was an inquiry committee report which sort of indicated that at best Mr. Modi's sin was a sin of omission, not acting in time to prevent the riots, but it was not actually a sin of commission. This is hotly disputed. But the net result was that Mr. Modi carries this view that the old regime consistently wanted to persecute him, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like in the US, right, when we express concerns that the state might be weaponized to persecute political opponents, both of these leaders say, look, but we've already experienced that, right? So that's, in a sense, kind of another commonality. And the last commonality, I'd just say, there's lots of more to talk about, is actually they also want to radically alter the nature of the economic order, and particularly the nature of, kind of, you might say, capitalism in their societies. So Mr. Modi is an interesting combination, like Mr. Trump, which is his support base. He produces a lot of identification amongst particularly lower middle classes. I mean, you know, saying, look, I'm an outsider, my own personal history, right, is exemplary of the way in which I identify with you. But his coalition is a coalition of the extremes. He's actually built a welfare coalition for a lot of economically marginalized groups, built out a welfare state, provided cash transfers, lots of government schemes. On the other end of the spectrum, India's top 1%, India's oligarchy. And in part, what he wants to do is, in a sense, kind of restructure the shape of Indian capitalism to make it respond to more industrial policy, more oligarchy. Now, again, he's been, I think, a little subtler about it than Mr. Trump is. India's richest men like Mr. Ambani and Mr. Adani don't actually run government. Yet, I think this coalition where a bunch of very powerful billionaires give their full backing, and you combine that with a populist alliance, actually makes them, you know, interesting parallel figures.
Yeah, I mean, that is the logic of Trump's kind of coalition. Yes. He hasn't done as much on the welfare front. I mean, even during his whole first term, as he might have if he were more competent and wanted to court his constituency. But I guess he may get around to that. And you know, he's mindful of what they want. And you're certainly right about the other end of the spectrum. So I want to make sure I'm clear on that, the historical event. So first, a Hindu mob tore down the mosque,
That was in 1992.
I get it. Okay, so that so the mosque had been there for, you know, half a millennium, but Hindus said it was on the birthplace of the Hindu god Ram, and maybe there's historical attestation, and maybe there had been a Hindu temple there. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so in a way, I mean, so some evidence, and the mosque had been actually disused for you know, actually quite a few decades, because it started in the late 19th century, and then in 1948, miraculously, some idols, Hindu idols, appeared in some senses in the precincts of the mosque. And so it was, in a sense, you know, basically put under kind of lock and key, as it were. So it was an inactive mosque, so to speak. But in 1992,
it was destroyed.
You know, BJP activists decided to raise it to the ground.
That's Modi's kind of party, political party, BJP.
Exactly right. An act of vigilantism. But even after they tore down the mosque, the property legally remained disputed, right? So you couldn't build the temple there. And there was a series of agitations asking for a temple to be built. And the important thing is not the temple, in some senses. It's not the religious significance of the place. Because actually, Ram temples are relatively rare in India. The importance is that this became a site of Hindu political supremacy, a symbol of Hindu political supremacy. So Mr. Modi's narrative about India is that Hindus have been subjugated by outsiders for 1,000 years. The most important subjugators were not the British. They were actually, in a sense, Muslims.
Even though
the Muslims had eventually settled in India, you know, created kind of empires, syncretic empires, kingdoms. And the act of reclaiming this site is a act of reclaiming the political sovereignty of Hindus. And so it becomes a symbol of, in a sense, a kind of ethnic consolidation, not just a religious site.
Yeah. I mean, it seems a little surprising from where I sit, which is to say a completely ignorant person knows nothing about it and is a long way away, that the resentment of Muslims has been that effective, because it's not as if they were the elites, right? In the case, I guess I would just say in America, the connection is the elites who don't care about you bring the immigrants in to take your jobs. So there's a very clear narrative connection.
Yeah.
Whereas in India, you know, overwhelmingly, there's a big Muslim population in absolute terms, and it's probably, I don't know, 15% or something in relative terms. But of course, most of the Muslims after partition wound up in Pakistan after India's independence. And so the Hindu, and most elites were Hindu, right? So I don't, and also it's just been a long time since Muslim subjugation. The Muslim empire was before British imperial rule. So I'm just a little puzzled by that, but it's not, you know, I shouldn't get hung up on it.
Just kind of a 2-minute version. So this is actually, I mean, an interesting problem. And again, I think comparisons with the US are interesting, where in a sense, you know, since 1857, which was kind of when the British Empire was, Queen Victoria formally becomes Queen of India, and power is transferred, to the British government from the East India Company, formally transferred. A debate opened up in India, which is what is going to be the character of India's national identity? And in particular, how would this national identity, in a sense, accommodate not just India's plurality, but one particular axis of plurality, which is Hindus and Muslims. I mean, India is plural in so many different ways, languages, castes, regions, and there are kind of ways in which India has actually done very well in accommodating them. Now, the core question in that debate was, how is power going to be shared amongst Hindus and Muslims? Right. So, in fact, in part, this question of the relationship between Hindus and Muslims takes a new articulation in modern times. This is not ancient history. I mean, at the level of religions, they kind of had accommodated each other. I mean, Indian vernacular practices, you know, it kind of seamlessly was. This is a question that actually arises within the context of democracy, because everybody basically realized India is going to be a democracy, or a future India is going to be a democracy. In democracies, numbers matter, right? Before a democracy, the concept of a majority and a minority does not quite politically have the same significance because numbers don't matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's in that context that this question arose, if Muslims are going to be a minority numerically, does democracy open up the possibility of Hindu majoritarian dominance through democracy, right? Now, you might say, well, why not go for the American solution? Create a constitution that gives every individual equal rights, right? That constitution then protects the minority or individuals within that minority, right? But the challenge with that view in India was that, well, actually, the constitution is going to have to be administered by someone. And if power still effectively remains with the majority, right, how will the concern for the minorities, in a sense, be accommodated? And I think the second issue, in a sense, related to this democratic issue was, what kind of public expression of religion would the majority and minority be allowed? And by public expression, we mean one specific thing. For example, are there domains of social life that can still be governed by religious law? So, for example, India has the system of personal laws where, you know, different religious communities, marriage, inheritance, law of divorce, and so forth, are governed by reformed religious laws in some ways, right? Now, what happens basically between 1857 and 1947 is this question never really gets resolved. If you deviate from one person, one vote, and give the minority a veto on some areas, the majority says, well, this is unfair. Why do they get to have a veto in excess of the, you know, numbers, right? On the other hand, if you don't give minorities special safeguards, right, they actually feel insecure and vulnerable. And it's in the process of that negotiation over democracy that actually the idea of Pakistan is born. I mean, apart from other things, you know, the making of Pakistan is a kind of complicated idea. But I do want to emphasize that this is a problem that kind of arises within the context of democracy. Now, what happens in 1947 is, in a sense, India gets partitioned. But the geographical spread of Muslims in India was that a neat demographic partition was simply not going to be not only possible, it would have been catastrophic. I mean, you know, India still has about, you know, 200 million plus Muslims. I mean, it's the second largest Muslim country in the world, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea was, okay, we can create a Muslim homeland on the subcontinent, which provides, if need be, a safe haven, but it doesn't mean that there will be a kind of neat demographic partition. Mm-hmm. Now, the BJP, Mr. Modi's party's demand historically has been that the logic of partition should have been accepted in its entirety, which means that if Pakistan is a Muslim state, mm-hmm. India needs to be a Hindu state, openly acknowledging the political supremacy of Hindus, right? And in some senses, politically and culturally marginalizing Muslims. So in part, and to draw European analogies in some senses. I mean, you know, and this is something that people often find a little bit intriguing and disturbing. Their model is actually Zionism, which is to say a form of nation state that openly acknowledges, in some senses, the ethnic character of that nation state, right? In some ways. Mm-hmm. And their demand since 1947 has been consistently A, for India to accept the logic of partition. And as a consequence of accepting that logic, right, politically and culturally marginalizing Muslims. I mean, there used to be sections of the party that literally had fantasies of kind of demographic removal, but even they know that's not realistic. And the agitation around building a temple in Ayodhya was the idea that if this temple is built over a mosque or a place where a mosque used to be, this would be an open assertion of Hindus reclaiming their political sovereignty, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of long-standing political argument in India, in some ways. The last and final thing I'll say on this, and then we can come to Mr. Trump in some ways, that it has to be said that one of the things that gave Hindu nationalism a lot of political momentum particularly after the 1990s and the 2000s, and then Mr. Modi's rise to power, was the charge he made that the previous Congress regime was not just accommodating Muslims, it was actually...
This is the party that had... the Congress party had dominated Indian politics.
Exactly, right.
Since independence.
Right. So it was actually appeasing Indian Muslims. How was it appeasing them? It was that regime had reformed Hindu personal law, but was refusing to reform Muslim personal law. I mean, that's one of the examples, right? It was too ready to, for example, ban Salman Rushdie's satanic verses, just because a small group of Muslims, in a sense, agitated against that book, right?
So that book banned in India by the prior government?
Yeah, yes. I mean, technically, okay. they imposed a customs order, but it made it illegal to import the book into India. Mm-hmm. And no Indian publisher would, in a sense, publish it for fear of being, in a sense, targeted. So it was, in a sense, effectively banned. Part of what Mr. Modi did was he actually, in some senses, and I think there was something to the critique that he made of Congress, saying that, look, there is a kind of old political dispensation that, in some senses, uses the Muslims as a vote bank. And they therefore have acquired a kind of veto on Indian policymaking. Now, a lot of this was not only exaggerated, because if you look at it in economic and social terms, actually the impoverishment of the Muslim community was absolutely astonishing under Congress. But there was, I mean, like Mr. Trump sometimes uses half plausible pretexts to further an agenda of kind of, you know, consolidated prejudice in some ways. I think the BJP did a lot of the same.
Yeah. Well, with the Salman Rushdie case, the suppression, I gather, in India of his book, The Satanic Verses, which, of course, a lot of Muslims didn't like. I do see some real parallels with Trump. I mean, you know, you could call that the enforcement of a speech code that evolved in part as a way of dealing with the challenges of a multi-ethnic state, right?
Yeah.
And the U.S. has various things that have evolved, like you're not supposed to use the N-word, and as well as laws like, certain forms of what you could call affirmative action. A liberal might call all of these things necessary adaptations to the challenge of having a multi-ethnic state.
Yeah.
But the Trumpists find them oppressive. They find the speech code oppressive. And so I really do, I do see analogies there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now, as for kind of practical applications, I'm curious as to what, well, before I even do any guiding of you to my preferred issues, are there critiques you would make about the way Trump's opponents have responded to him, either during his first term or now, tactics that you think may actually be counterproductive, may wind up empowering him or, empowering his base or whatever?
You know, look, I mean, we can all do armchair politics, right? And second guess how people...
It's a living.
In some ways, I think one of the, challenges is that, and just to stick with the free speech case, because I think it's quite illustrative in some ways, right? Which is, I think we are in a kind of political moment and a kind of ideological structure where you are kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't in some respects, right? Just to take the free speech example, right? Which is my own personal view, I tend to be much more of a kind of free speech absolutist, and it kind of breaks my heart, any act of censorship other than kind of, things that kind of exploit children and stuff, in part because it's a kind of loss of faith and trust in humanity. But having said that, right, we are in a kind of equilibrium, as you said, where everybody had their one favorite exception to whatever free speech principle they have espoused. Mm-hmm. Except now everybody's exceptions are on the table And the contest is over which group can have its exception imposed on the rest, right? Mm-hmm. In some ways. So unless you have an absolute courage of your own conviction on the absolutism of free speech, you are actually going to be tied in knots on this issue one way or the other, right? In some ways. But I think there are two or three, I think, structural issues, which I think are parallel, where I won't kind of blame individuals, but I think it's worth thinking about. So one issue is the following, which is Mr. Trump runs against a corrupt old system, right? This deep state, whatever he calls it, right? This mm-hmm. elitist system. And I think the one commonality between the Congress Party and the Democratic Party is that the party, they're very easily able to identify the party with that old system, right? In part, they're very easily able to identify with just in terms of personnel. So all Mr. Modi had to do was point to the Gandhi family and say, look, this is that old dynastic rule. He doesn't even have to say anything else. And I think half the population understands those associations, right? And the inability to actually generate a leadership that is not tagged with the baggage of the old system, right? Which is not tagged with, well, but you compromised on free speech then, you did this. I mean, sometimes personnel is actually policy in politics, right? Maybe Barack Obama was that brief opening. He was also an outsider in some ways. I mean, that was part of the kind of enthusiasm, the hope, not tagged in a sense with the baggage of that old establishment, right? Mm-hmm. And I think both parties are struggling with that, where all that Trump has to do is just point to individual names. You don't even have to say anything else, right? It's not even about the positions they take now, right? So one is, I think, this question of kind of how do parties, in the face of a moment that requires where people are clamoring for some kind of radical change, where there is consensus, whatever we want, we don't want that old system. Don't throw the ancient regime back at us, right? Mm-hmm. You need to generate a new kind of leadership. And I think both party structures, I mean, the elders of the party structure, if you might want to call it party establishments, have, I think, struggled with that problem. I'm not saying that there's an easy solution to that problem, but I think they have struggled with that problem. I think that's I think one. I think the second, I think, commonality I see, I think, is this incredible policy wonkishness and, you might say, almost public deference to technocracy. Now, I ran a policy think tank and I absolutely advocate for knowledge in government systems as much as possible. But I think there is a gap between the way in which dominant expertise represents what's going on in an economy and what's going on in society, and the way a lot of ordinary people feel through their experience of what's actually going on. I mean, it mm-hmm. comes up very strongly, for example, in debates over the economy, right? I mean, you read the pro-Biden administration's economics records, and everybody will say, like, this is the greatest economy ever. I mean, right? Except for a brief period, low inflation, low employment. And it's not that they're making things up. It's not that they, it isn't. I mean, there wasn't some truth to it. But I think one of the things parties that rely on technocracy in some senses, I think, struggle with a lot is how do you close this gap between the way in which your knowledge systems represent society and the economy to you, and the way it, in a sense, voters experience it, right? The third thing I'd say, I mean, there's a lot to be said, but the third thing which I think is important, which is one advantage the right has had in India and possibly in the United States, unlike the left and center, I'm using the terms loosely, is that the right is not playing the game just of winning the next election, right? Its strategy is just not focused on saying, how do I win the marginal district, the swing vote in a particular state? Of course, it focuses on that. The right has risen on the backs of a long-term social movement where there are lots of civil society organizations that are trying to, in a sense, transform the moral common sense, right? And the BJP, Mr. Modi has a huge advantage in that because there is this organization called the RSS, which is a Hindu civil society organization that believes in politically organizing Hindus, in some senses, culturally organizing.
It has a little bit of a kind of a militia vibe, right? And Modi was, right? was part of that yeah. from a very young age.
Absolutely. And part of that empowerment, it has a militia vibe, although they don't carry guns. That's one uh-huh. big difference. In India, actually carrying guns is still, fortunately for the most part, outlawed. Yeah. And the RSS doesn't kind of valorize it. But it is militia. I mean, it's strong arm tactics. They have been alleged to participate in riots in some cases, or at least intervene in riots in some cases. And there's a kind of cult of masculinity about it. I mean, that's the, I think, the important sort of point. But there are also other civil society organizations whose job is in some, which are actually even more violent than the RSS, who will selectively target Muslims, for example, you know, one or two lynchings here and there to send out a message of terror to the, you know, that in some senses terrorizes the larger community. So there is a kind of structure of vigilante violence. But the political success doesn't just come from this structure of vigilante violence. It actually comes from a whole range of organizations, religious organizations, cultural organizations, social service organizations. The RSS, for example, runs a lot of schools. You know, it'll do kind of flood relief work, all kinds of social activities, right? Which actually normalize these ideologies as, you know, just quotidian cultural activity, right? Mm-hmm. And the point is to, in a sense, transform cultural consciousness in the long term. It's not simply focused on the next election. In India, at least, the left and center has no equivalent. I mean, there are no unions doing organizing. There's no mass outreach program or civic education. You know, the Congress party and the left parties, they basically wake up 6 months before the election and say, okay, how do we strategize in the next election? The right has recognized, at least, you know, the two mantras the Indian right operates with, which is one is politics is downstream from culture. You need to capture yeah. culture as much. And the second is, you know, despite their fascination with modern technology, with the information order, social media, information bubbles, they actually still believe in a lot of old-fashioned face-to-face interaction. Mr. Modi's
You're talking about the right.
Yeah, the right. Uh-huh. Yeah. So Mr. Modi's great success is founded on the fact that there are all these civil society organizations. I mean, you know, they'll come even talk to us much more extensively. You know, I've been visited by the left and Congress circles, you know, because we are part of those circles as elites. But in years, I've never been visited by a Congress worker asking for my vote, even though, you know, we kind of lean in that direction. So I think the ability to, in a sense, I think, mobilize civil society to transform moral and cultural consciousness, that ability seems to be much greater in the right, at least in India, than here.
Okay. So listen, we've been talking, I think, more than 45 minutes. Yeah. And what we normally do is time flies. What we normally do here is we have kind of a part of the conversation that is for the public, and then we keep talking in what we call overtime, and that is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. You can become one by clicking a link in your show notes or on YouTube or just Googling Non-Zero newsletter. I want to give people some sense for what we're going to talk about in overtime. I do want to continue to talk about what you were just talking about, because I'm not sure the Trumpist right is as well organized as it sounds like the right is in India. But I also want to raise this whole question about how to resist Trump wisely. So the Non-Zero newsletter, here's a little history. originally, when I started it, it was called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. This was in 2017. I just published a book about mindfulness meditation. And the idea was that it probably makes sense to resist Trump mindfully, not in the sense of necessarily meditating, but in the sense of responding with kind of careful consideration, not letting your emotions get the better of you, and so on. And so, for example, I said, you know, don't denigrate his followers. You know, don't do that. Okay. And yet, you know, there was quite a bit of it, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, like on this Russiagate thing, like, well, we haven't seen a smoking gun yet. There's an investigation. Let it proceed. But don't talk too much about how we, you know, you're sure he's in league with Vladimir Putin. Because if it turns out there's no smoking gun, that's going to backfire on you. And there was no smoking gun, and it backfired. And I said some other things that and I wouldn't say all my other things I've said have been vindicated. A lot of people would say the two things I've already mentioned were vindicated. But I'm genuinely unsure about how to proceed. I mean, one thing that happens to me is people say, well, now that Trump is just full on making the authoritarian lurch, what do you have to say now when you were telling us to be calm? And my line is kind of, well, maybe if we'd been a little calmer, he wouldn't have been reelected. But anyway, I want you to dive into that whole question. Like, how do you react with some degree of force without feeding the narrative of his persecution, the narrative that you have contempt for his followers, and how do you avoid abetting him in other ways? Because it really is hard. And relatedly, I want to ask you, when you stepped down from the university, was that a victory for him? I mean, you know, and so I want to get into all these questions. But first, I want to give you a chance to, tell us where we can find your work, if you have a place, if you're on any social media, or if there's a website you'd like people to go to, or any other books you want to mention.
So the easiest thing, in a sense, is to, I do have a kind of X handle at PB Mehta. And the one thing I do there is I actually post all my columns there. So the kind of chronology, some of them unfortunately are now going behind a paywall, but there are ways of sort of people can still get access to it. But particularly the Indian Express column is I've been writing it for almost 20 years now. So it actually is a sort of almost like a running history, contemporary history in some senses. But the columns are not just about Indian politics, they're about world affairs. They give me a free hand. So sometimes they're political philosophy musings as well. But I think that's probably the most kind of accessible stuff, I think, for your listeners.
So then the Twitter handle, if I've got it right, is P as in Peter, B as in Bob, M as in Mary, and then E-H.
Right.
T as in Tom, A.
Yeah.
Which is your two initials and your last name.
Right.
Mehta. Okay, well, thank you so much for this. Now we're going to keep talking in overtime. I hope people join us in any event. Thanks for listening so far.